Welcome to the Gooder Podcast, where we talk with powerhouse women in CPG about their journeys to success. This episode is sponsored by Retail Voodoo, a brand development firm guiding mission-driven consumer brands to attract new and passionate consumer base, crush their categories through growth and innovation, and magnify their social and environmental impact. If your brand is in need of brand positioning, package design, or marketing activation, we are here to help. You can find more information at www.retail-voodoo.com.
Well, hello. Welcome to the Gooder Podcast, where I talk with the powerhouse women in the food, beverage, and wellness categories about their journeys to success and their insights on the industry. This episode is brought to you by Retail Voodoo, a brand development firm. Our clients include Starbucks, Kind, REI, PepsiCo, HiQ, and many other market leaders. We provide strategic brand and design services for leading brands in the food, wellness, beverage, and fitness industries. If your goal is to increase market share, drive growth, or disrupt the marketplace with new and innovative ideas, give us a call and let's talk. For more information, check out retail-voodoo.com. Now, before introducing today's guest, I want to give a big thank you to my friend, Andrea Houston, for making this connection. Andrea Houston is the founder and CEO of Artitudes, a communications firm that focuses on content and design development, as well as speaker coaching for business leaders nationwide. Artitudes is considered every presenter's partner for speaking and events. For coaching, content, and management support for your next event or presentation, check it out at www.artitudes.com. I hope I did you well there, Missy Andrea. Okay. Well, today we get to meet Miss Jean Thompson, who is many things: mother, entrepreneur, world traveler, and most importantly in this conversation, a chocolate lover. A native New Englander, Jean graduated from Bates College before embarking on a career in high tech. Between software and chocolate, Jean was raising two children in Bellevue, Washington, and devoting her free time to nonprofit work. After the big 2001 Nisqually earthquake here in Seattle, which is a big one for those of you folks outside of Seattle might not know that, the Seattle chocolate manufacturing facility was in ruins. Jean took the job of owner and CEO, relocating the factory and running the daily operations for the company. Jean's determination, willingness to learn and adapt, and curiosity fueled her as she led the company into a new era. In the process, Jean grew from a marketer to business visionary and from chocolate eater to chocolate maven, yes, with a sense of purpose. Well, hello, Jean. How are you today?
Good. Hello, Diana.
Hi. So are you in Seattle proper?
Right now I'm in West Seattle. I'm working, you know, working from home.
Okay.
And Seattle Chocolate Factory is located in Tukwila, so just a couple of miles away from the airport.
Oh, okay, great. So I have to say, I'm a hazelnut everything, by the way, but hazelnut and malted milk ball truffle fan from your products. And last summer, I tried your, I think it was new vanilla orange cream truffle at the Sweets and Snack Show, and I was pleasantly surprised. So big fan of Seattle chocolates for a long time. Of course, it's a Northwest brand and love what you guys are doing over there.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Of course. Now, I always have to start. We always have to start with the brand. Can you tell us a little bit about Seattle Chocolate Company and why it exists?
Yeah. So Seattle Chocolate Company is in its 30th year. And I've been involved with it for the last almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. And it really has two brands. One is has been around since the beginning, and it's called Seattle Chocolate. Mm-hmm. And it's really, its reason for being is really all about brightening people's days. It started as a chocolate gift company 30 years ago. Gift boxes are kind of our specialty. Mm-hmm. The little twist wrap truffles you were referencing a few minutes ago, those are kind of our specialty. 15 different flavors, lots of variety. Mm-hmm. And all the flavor, both the bars and the truffles on the Seattle Chocolate line are meltaways or truffles, as we call them, meaning that they just melt away in your mouth. And so they're really creamy and delicious. And it's all about brightening people's day through gifting or eating it yourself. Mm-hmm. And then we came up with another line 10 years ago called J Coco. And really the intention behind that was to take it away from a regional name in case it was providing any limitations. And also to have sort of a different sort of product line. And we call it J Coco, J for Jean and Coco for chocolate. And it's basically our culinary line. So yeah. that one had a built-in philanthropic mission of stomping out hunger in the U.S. from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And we've already donated, you know, over 4 million servings of food to 3 American food banks in New York, San Francisco, and in our own backyard, Northwest Harvest, which feels so good, so affirming. And this is so interesting because you really can leverage the popularity of chocolate and give your consumers who are going to buy and eat chocolate anyway, the power to help their neighbors in their time of need. And that one is it's our culinary line. By that, I mean, it's a solid bar. It has whole pieces of fig and pistachio or crisped quinoa and sesame, or has an 85% dark. It's based on chocolate that was both grown and post-harvested and made in Peru. So it's a very premium, fine chocolate brand. So both of them sort of serve a purpose, two different purposes for us in the world of chocolate.
Yeah. I remember when J. Coco came out and I called it the grown-up chocolate. I know it's, definitely targeting the foodie, but if I remember correctly, it was kind of one of those first brands that started to integrate kind of, not an inclusion. I'm using the wrong word here, but
that is like, the right word actually.
Okay.
I'm impressed. Yeah.
Inclusion. Well, we've worked with a number of chocolate types of brands. So I have a general, not anywhere near close understanding as you, but kind of like those whole pieces in the sophisticated rather than just a nut or a raisin or a marzipan or something like that. Is that correct?
Yeah. What we try to do with that is we think of ourselves as sort of the chefs at the end of the line. Mm-hmm. So we're chocolatiers. Mm-hmm. And so we will pair a particular chocolate with a particular group or two or three different inclusions that complement each other, much like a chef would take fine ingredients and whole foods from wherever he feels the best chicken or the best, you know, spices are from. And then he or she combines them in a way that sort of elevates the whole experience. And that's our goal with J. Coco. Nice. And a really great example of that is that we used to have chocolate from Nicaragua, and we were trying to do our most popular bar is a fig and pistachio bar. And we tried to do that in a 80% Nicaraguan chocolate. And you could no longer taste the fig because it was a figgy kind of profile on the chocolate, delicious chocolate. But then, so we had to go back to our sort of Belgian chocolate that we use in our Seattle chocolate line so that it's sort of neutral and fudgy and you could hear those, you could taste those accents. So now we source from Peru and we have a 72% Peruvian chocolate, and all of a sudden the figs are exponentially more flavorful.
Really?
So it really matters which chocolate you choose and specify to go with which ingredients.
Oh, I would love, I don't know if it's at all possible, but wouldn't it be fun to do like different chocolate, regional chocolates or regional cocoa with a single inclusion and just be able to like a wine, but instead of trying a 75 versus a 3% versus, you know, all of the different variables, but like take the same varietal with the same inclusion and just have that moment. I think that, I mean, I know that's what your innovation team is doing all the time, but as a consumer and a foodie, that would be a fun journey to have as well.
And I love that you're saying that because I feel like I did a TED talk a couple of years ago that was called Imagine a World Without Chocolate, and talking about needing to pay the farmers fairly because the amount of work and craft and science and honestly, black magic at times that goes into making a chocolate bar is incredible. Like people have no idea. They have no idea that it's a fermented product. They have no idea that there's so much craft around roasting it. And then even the post, you know, how long you ferment it, how long you dry it, and all of that really impacts the resulting flavor, not to mention the genetics of the cacao, of which there are 10 different genetic varietals that have been identified just in the last few years.
Really?
Much like wine. And so our goal with J. Coco is to elevate the whole experience so people treat chocolate like a craft food rather than that cheap Halloween candy.
Yes.
Not that there's anything wrong with it. But yeah, we love it. I mean, I still love an M&M, right? It's just a great quality little confection. But chocolate is really more like a food.
You know, it is
in cooking and of course in baking, you can sprinkle or grate it onto a salad and you can do it as a rim around a really delicious and innovative cocktail. So I love the fact that you're like, your brain immediately went to, wait a second, what if we could compare what a bean from Peru versus Nicaragua versus Dominican Republic, all of that at 72%. So you're sort of isolating some variables.
Yes.
Really interesting.
Yeah. Very much like what we're doing with coffee these days a lot.
Exactly. Yeah, coffee and chocolate have a lot in common.
Yes. Well, so now I love this. The chocolate maven came right out the shoot. I love this.
No time. Yeah. Wasting and small talk.
Yes. Now, let's stop, go back just a little bit. Your story sort of starts, I mean, and there's a little bit before Microsoft, but for all intents and purposes, there's a good part of your journey that is at Microsoft, mm-hmm. That is the precursor to your time here at Seattle Chocolate. Can you tell us a little bit of that journey from Microsoft and maybe what kind of has stayed with you or carried you over that kind of helped you into the Seattle chocolate world, a CPG product versus a tech product?
Yeah. And when I was at Microsoft, I was in corporate communication. So advertising, package design. Uh-huh. So you can actually see how that job prepared me really well for a CPG kind of product and company. And then also just working in marketing was extremely helpful. I mean, that is the area of the company that I am probably most involved with and that I have the most opinions on, much to their chagrin, and packaging design and all of that. Very, very important to me because of my background, and it's my strength, right?
Yes.
It's what I, what I came to the party with. So that was, and then also I think Microsoft at that time, was only about 2000 employees.
Wow.
And so it was the early days, but you still had to learn and, how to work with many different types of people so because I was the advertising agency within, Microsoft, of which there were 100 of us at that time. It was the biggest ad agency in all of Seattle.
Can you believe it?
And it was internal. And, I used to have to work with the product managers on products like SQL Server and Land Manager.
I remember.
And, you know, C and Fortran, but also on Excel. I worked on the launch of Excel. Yes. I worked on Word and all these really fun that really are CPG products.
Mm-hmm.
They were sort of in that mode of changing from a, IT kind of purchase to on the shelf. So it was really pretty good direct experience for me.
Mm-hmm. Different need state, but technically, yes, the talking with the consumer and the drivers and what entices people is absolutely linear.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and I loved working at Microsoft in those days. It was so exciting. And I was in my 20s and I had so much responsibility. Oh my gosh. And, you know, I don't know what it's like today, but it was a great place back then. It was like the Wild West of Microsoft.
Oh my gosh. I bet you probably... No, I used to work with, I worked at Safeco down the street from that main campus and, of course knew many people there. Still do. So great, great times when it was young.
Yeah.
It's different now, but it's larger. So
a little.
Now it's really important for people to understand that the Nisqually earthquake that happened here in Seattle, it was pretty, I mean, it's been 20 years now, so it's not on everybody's radar, but it was a pretty, shook up the region pretty well. And then that Starbucks building, that area down there in SoTo, which everybody outside of Seattle, SoTo is like kind of, really where a lot of, commercial work is done in the city. The business is in kind of the core. And manufacturing is outside and now even moving to the Kent area where you are. So Gene, you stepped in this pivotal moment for Seattle Chocolate. And can you share what happened to the company at the time and why you personally, you know, what was it about the situation that had you stepping into that role? Like you weren't working there. I don't think you were.
No.
So can you tell, why did you want to bring this brand out of crisis? What was going through your head at that time?
At the time we were an investor, like maybe, one of a dozen different investors that were there from the start of Seattle Chocolate. And, Seattle Chocolate really suffered, struggled, I should say, for the first 10 years and never had it easy. If you think about, they had 9/11 the exact same year as, you know, like 7 months on the heels of an earthquake that destroyed their building.
Right.
And they didn't have insurance for earthquake, which a lot of companies don't believe.
Yeah. A lot of didn't. Yeah.
Yeah. I do. Anyway, and then somebody had to step in and move it, which is extremely expensive when you have two large, plants that you need to move and you have to move into a building that's insulated and temperature controlled. Mm-hmm. And it took a lot of money to fund that. And for whatever reason, I've been a chocoholic and chocolate fan my whole life. And I thought that the company had a tremendous amount of potential. Mm-hmm. I liked the products and it just seemed a shame. And, at that time, My ex-husband and I were sort of dabbling in angel investing and that kind of thing. So we looked at it as that kind of an opportunity. And then when we did that, we became the owners.
Okay.
Yep.
So you saw it as an opportunity.
I didn't really think through like, oh, I have an opportunity through this. I mean, when I say really, I didn't think that at all. I just thought, well, at least this company needs it. We'll start, you know, we'll put it in. And it wasn't for another year when they came back and said, hey, you know, we still can't cover payroll. And I said something snarky, like, oh, for God's sake, how hard can this be? It's chocolate, right? And believe me, I have rued the day that I said that many, many times, because it's actually ridiculously complicated. It's manufacturing, it's warehousing, it's, you know, CPG, it's everything in a tiny, small company. And you're doing it in an expensive city. And also in the upper left-hand corner, incredibly far and difficult to ship. So everything about it was extremely complicated, which I totally respect now, but at the time. And then I thought, well, you know, my youngest went off to kindergarten a month later, and I thought, well, I'll just help them. I'll just, you know, help them with their marketing.
Yeah.
And I won't even collect a paycheck. I'll just, after kickboxing and before Ellie and Danny are done with school, I'll just work for 3 hours. And within 6 weeks, the guy quit, and I was faced with the decision on what to do and chose to step up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
A little moment.
Yes. Well, let's talk about your leadership then in that moment. You know, what sort of tools are you using, or what sort of tools did you bring in with you, or did you have to create to kind of calm and manage the employees?
Oh, I didn't have any tools at my disposal.
Nothing.
I knew nothing. I had never stepped foot in a manufacturing facility until that one. The only warehouse was Costco. I really didn't know anything about business. I was always the sort of creative, you know, more right-brained person on an assignment or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'd never even read a financial statement at that point. So I went in as a total noob. And the thing I had going for me was that I am an undying optimist. I was like, oh, how hard can it be, right? That attitude. And I can do it. And the other thing that was key for me was that I didn't have anybody else to report to. There was no board. I was the owner. So whatever I chose to do, I didn't have to answer to anybody. And, and you know, that was really critical, because I had no confidence. I felt like an imposter the entire time.
Of course.
But I was like, oh, well, I think it's a good idea. So no one else really needs to agree or not agree. And that was key.
So curious, was there any one or a couple of choices that you made at that time that, looking back now that you have all your business knowledge, that you're like, if I would have come into this with this knowledge, I wouldn't have made that move. And then this would not have happened.
Oh, there's a list so long.
That oh, it's
actually embarrassing. Someday I should write it down just as like spoofs or, you know.
Yes.
But the one that sticks in my mind, which just shows how foolhardy and optimistic I was we got an account with Target. And it was a private label bar that they wanted to do. And they came to us and we figured out how to do it. And the thing that was killing us was the freight. Still a true story today. I mean, it's the most expensive thing. And it's just ironic that everybody expects it for free. But so I thought, well, I'm just going to buy a truck. How hard can this be? Right. So I literally bought 2 semi trucks. And then I went about learning the rules of the road and finding, you know, commercial drivers, which were really hard and probably still very hard to find. And then there was all these rules. You can't deliver. You have to drive this long, Learned all of that. And because I had 12, I think, different warehouses that I needed to deliver to. And so they went about doing it, crossing the Rockies in the winter, all this stuff I hadn't factored in.
Yes.
I think it took me 9 to 12 months before I sold them for pennies on the dollar and was like, okay, respect to the transportation industry. We'll never do that again. However, when I'm talking to them, hello, Doc. When I'm talking to people who are in transportation, I understand, right? So while it was extremely costly, it was also great. Like, I'm like, wait a second, but what about this? Are you allowed to, you know, I understand the ins and outs of that because I had to do it. So that's number one favorite example.
I was half expecting to hear that you actually drove the ship.
I would have. If I didn't have 2 kids at home and if I had a CDL, I would have for sure.
I find that to be true of a lot of business owners, but typically I find that sort of gumption happen with the founder owners, right? Yeah. Not necessarily. So it's so fascinating to me to hear you've adopted this brand as though it were your own, very much so.
Yeah, no, I was also under, I joined this organization called Entrepreneur Organization, which is how I know
Andrea,
thank you. Yes. And it's been super helpful to me, but I was like, I'm not an entrepreneur. I didn't start the company. Like I'm an imposter. But what I came to realize is that it's really a state of mind and an attitude. And I definitely had it. And I had a lot to prove to myself, to my family, to the company and employees and to the world that I could do this, because there was really no reason to believe that I could.
Interesting. Yeah. It very much is a state of mind, but I would say that Seattle Chocolates is incredibly lucky to find somebody that can have that commitment and the compassion for a brand in that way, because it's not common. And it's certainly something special and one that people should know more about. Like, I think it's possible to own a brand and love it the same way as a founder. I really do think it's possible.
100%. Yeah. And what it's done for my life, how it's changed every aspect of my life, how I feel about myself, what I think about the future, my contribution for my life on how I will help the community or the world or the environment has been so influenced by Seattle Chocolate. And Seattle Chocolate's my tool. It's my my great privilege to be able to use such a popular product like chocolate and make a difference.
Well, I wonder now, we're kind of going through another crisis, or we're coming out of another crisis in this COVID moment. Are you finding any similarities between when you first came in during that crisis moment and now, whether it's the dynamics of the employees or the business culture or anything like that?
Well, this was definitely a lot easier. For sure. By then I'd already been around for, 17 years, 18 years, and my people were rock solid. They really were just so there for me. I mean, we had to bolster our, infrastructure, I would say, more meetings, more write up the meeting and copy more people so that everybody knows what's going on. Cause comms, you don't have that hallway conversation anymore. We started with happy hours. Those weren't really necessary. We learned just like people were like, yet another meeting. Thanks for that. No. So that didn't work. We tried different things. Every week I send out a weekly note from the CEO highlighting what's going on. I mean, it's kind of long and I think people probably skim it. And the other thing I include in that, but they know it's all there, all the information, everything that happened that week. And then at the end, I have what's called the Jeans list as a play on the Dean's list of people who represented our values really well.
Oh, nice.
And I cannot get over how much that means to people. Like,
really?
It's never inauthentic. It's always something that they did that represented our values really well, that would stand out, that was above and beyond. And people, I think, in general, would rather be recognized and appreciated than to even be paid. If there was a way you could live on that, you would, right? So those little things that we did helped, and we kept up the quarterly planning and the business planning that we have always done, made the circle a little bit bigger, not just our leadership team, but a superset of that, of people who then know what's going on. And I guess it's really about over-communicating and over-inclusive, including.
Are you, so of course we do, we are big brand builders. Well, that's what we do as a core at Retail Voodoo. And I hear you say our values. Are you able to share some of those core values with us? Like, you know, what are those things that you see exuded most frequently by the employees kind of in either internally or outwardly?
Yeah. Our values are like right there in our one page strategic plan. I'll see if I can remember them off the top of my head. I should. First would be working in a spirit of collaboration. We're a small company. There's not a lot of employees. If someone's really busy over here, then someone should ebb and help them. And and they really, really do. And they're always recognized for it. They recognize each other for it and they thank each other for it.
That's wonderful. So
it's, it's key as a small company. Stop at nothing for, actually we used to say stop at nothing. We revised the customer service thing to mean do the right thing in customer service, because the stopping at nothing, you can actually get taken advantage of. And that doesn't feel good. So we, you know, we want to do the right thing by the customer each and every time, as long as they're being fair or not taking advantage of us. Then there is, cherishing and, empowering diversity. So not just having them on staff, but hearing them, because that's why you want them. They offer such a different point of view and perspective, and they help us, you know, sort of mimic our audience, right? Mm-hmm. So that we have to hear them and celebrate them. Mm-hmm. And then innovation. So we pride ourselves of being very creative and innovative, and we hold those things up in the highest regard. Yes, efficiency is important. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's good to make money. Mm-hmm. But really, if we feel like we're innovating, we're so happy. And the type of people that do well there are people who are like that, or yep. at least understand and accept and embrace that. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I think the last one is always kind, meaning kind to the planet, kind to our vendors. Oh, be kind right there. Mm-hmm. But always, because we say it's just chocolate, right? I mean, we super value and respect right? chocolate, but at the end of the day, it's not,
we're not world saving peace, lives.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, the cure for cancer. So mm-hmm. let's just be kind to each other, because there's some times when it gets hairy in the chocolate industry. Yes. Fourth quarter, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh my goodness. And trade show season.
Yeah.
That gets pretty hairy too.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's what I love hearing, is this kind of inclusion of your tenants in your weekly comms, and that it's not just something that's printed somewhere on the website, discussed once a year in an annual meeting, that you guys are living and breathing in. I think that's super foundational to the success of any organization. Thanks for sharing those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So now the chocolate industry, you know, we're going to talk a little bit more about COVID. I think in those first few weeks when everything went into lockdown, I think things got a little bit scary. I don't know how you guys, or how you handled it, or how your team handled it. I know you built something over the long term. How did you guys come together in those first few weeks before we started to see like DTC sales start to go like this? I believe there was a 12% increase in chocolate sales overall. I don't know about your particular segment, but I'm assuming it was on par with that, if not higher, because of the nature of the quality of your product. But how did those first few weeks go? How did you calm people down?
Wow. Yeah. I actually was really of the belief, and have completely changed, that we were going to be, inefficient working from home, and that it was going to be really detrimental to the company. And it kept me going that we kept hearing it like 1 month at a time. It's March, but we'll be back by June. And it was like, oh, can we make it that far? And then September. And then after that, people got wise and were like, you know, it's going to be another year. Don't worry about it. And so it was a little, was of course very uncertain. We didn't know. And luckily a lot of us had laptops, and we had a great IT guy that could get us sort of set up and meetings. And we quickly, you know, rallied to get Zoom and different sorts of like Trello kind of tools. There was all of that going on. And then we also, we knew that this working from home thing was going to be a great opportunity for e-com. So we immediately came up with like three or four different, what we called care packages at the time, and now we call gift boxes, that people could share. Like normally we'd be together for your birthday, but I'm going to send this instead. And so our e-com sales, like you said, they just grew, they doubled, right?
They doubled.
Yeah. But the rest of our business didn't double.
Right.
I mean, it was definitely down. And part of that is our name, Seattle Chocolate. We're really big in hospitality. So we have our own store at the airport. And
yes.
Hudson News is an important customer, and as is Alaska Airlines.
And oh, my
goodness.
All
of us were just crushed.
Yep.
So it really impacted our business a lot. Mm-hmm. So we were very thankful for the PPP. Mm-hmm. But we had a lot of fun, and I think it was quite distracting, and everybody was really proud of our innovation. And so that kind of, and we shared it with everybody. So production was like, oh, that's cool. We're out there growing, and somehow we're not just sitting back hunkering down and being defensive. We're actually being aggressively innovative. And so I think that was really comforting.
And how are you guys handling this, the scale or the, you know, the velocity of growth right now? You've got not only the increase in online sales, but all of us are struggling with supply chain and employee retention and all the things. Have you guys stabilized somewhat, or are you still a little bit rocky like most of the other folks out there?
So in terms of our staffing, we've been blessed. I mean, during the whole thing, I mean, we have probably a dozen different people in retail, mm-hmm. and they would have been out of work, you know, but we never laid them off. We they just stayed at home and waited and waited mm-hmm. and, you know, and some of them went to our office and helped people mm-hmm. pick and send samples or, you know, helped in other ways. Mm-hmm. So nobody was ever laid off. And I feel like I have such loyalty from them because of that. Like,
yes,
they stick with us.
Yes.
And we've only lost like maybe a handful of people, and that could have happened anyway. Just moving. Yes. One of them had been with us for over 15 years and wow. was ready for a change kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the people thing has been, and I'm knocking wood like crazy, because I feel like, of course, nothing's more important than our employees.
Right.
And the fact that they're sticking with us is, has been, you know, really, make or break it for us. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. As far as the supply chain, that was a nightmare. And that of course didn't really hit us till 2021.
Really?
We're told in September, and I mean, I guess that doesn't mean as much to the listeners, but for us, it's a very seasonal business. Mm-hmm. And
yes,
September through January is where it all comes down for chocolate. You got Christmas, you got Valentine's shortly mm-hmm. on the heels, and it's the busiest time of year. And so in September, we were told that we wouldn't get two of our chocolate shipments. And we were like, what? You can't do that. So anyway, we, had to rob from Peter to pay Paul and discontinue yeah. the slower selling chocolates
yep.
to give that chocolate to the better selling. And, mm-hmm. and I have to say our brokers, our distributors, our customers were so understanding.
Good.
Like, we didn't lose customers because of it. We lost business and sales, as did they.
Yeah.
But everybody understood, like we were all kind of in it together. So it's one of those rare unifying moments, I think, in our country that we were like, we get it. Transportation is super slow. Mm-hmm. We can't rely on it showing up, that kind of thing. Mm. So we survived. I think we're largely out of it, but we don't trust anybody anymore.
Yeah, we don't trust anything either. Not because we don't trust our partner, but we just don't know what that partner's.
That's right.
Yeah. And I'm learning so much. In August, I went back to school to get my MBA and in my cohort, is a group of people from Expeditors International, which you may or may not mm-hmm. be doing business with. They do global mm-hmm. transportation. And I listened to on my team, one of the people on my team just talks about the pain that is happening. Like, who would have known that shipping and global transportation would be in the center of the spotlight and there'd be any issues, but everything from tariffs to just not finding employees. And like their biggest problem right now is they can't find people that want to come into the office to place the orders. They have these orders that are, so like they have managers and director levels that are sitting in the seats and plugging in the orders. And you just got to do what you got to do to make sure that business keeps going. Because without them, there's no commerce. It's not like you just don't do it.
Yeah.
You know, you just got to do it.
I mean, we had ships coming from Peru. Ironically, our Peruvian, much smaller chocolate maker was super reliable, had his stuff on the water, but it took an extra 6 or 8 weeks to unload it.
Yeah.
You know, to even just get it off the ocean and onto a truck because there's no truck drivers. And oh my gosh, it was super frustrating, but hopefully it's behind us.
I can't. Yeah. Well, and then there'll be the next thing, but we'll be better prepared for the next thing, I hope.
Nothing surprises us.
Yeah.
That's basically the silver lining.
Yes. Well, you know, as you're looking back over the last few years, is there any one moment that you'd like to highlight that you are especially proud of about the work that you've done either with Seattle Chocolates or about the brand itself?
There's so many moments in terms of the brand and the product that I'm proud of. We have so many fun flavors, so much innovation. Mm-hmm. We partner with artists, you know, to really bring, you know, color and interest to the shelves of a grocery store.
Yes.
Love working with them. I mentioned J. Coco's Giving Mission is a big source of pride for us. And I guess I would share it. Maybe it's going into the future a little bit, but it just happened last month. We launched a giving mission for Seattle Chocolate. So Seattle Chocolate was always like super generous. And if somebody had an auction and they needed something, we would do it. Or if one of the products was about pride, we'd give to an organization there. Mm-hmm. If one of the products, and it was a little bit scattered. And we decided, like we learned from J. Coco and how good that felt to actually make a difference, to write a decent sized check, right? So we decided to donate with each and every item, whether it's a single truffle, a bar, a gift, and everything in between for Seattle Chocolate, we donate to Girls Inc. which is a national organization, hopefully familiar with it, where they're all about lifting girls up, right? Knocking down some of the obstacles that our society does throw girls' way still, and helping them find their voice and be bold and have opportunity and be the future leaders. And we feel like that's such a good fit for who we are. We're largely, I mean, we probably are 75 to 80% women at our company, not by choice or selection at all. I always go for the best candidate. And for whatever reason, probably because they're drawn to me as a female business leader. That I tend to get more, have more women. And so we're like, you know what, we want the next generation of women. It's just difficult to find women leaders. I mean, isn't there some statistic that there's more CEOs named John than there are women CEOs in the United States?
I wrote a paper about it recently. It's the disparity is still pretty alarming. What I have noticed is that, and this is where Girls Inc. The reason why it's so important to start it then is, and we can understand this as business owners, is it's about pipeline. If we don't start the conversation early enough, that it's just not on their radar or even an area of interest, right? So if we only have X percent, 3% or 4% of women in the Fortune 500 C-suite, then they're only able to create visibility to that many people. So we just have to create the pipeline. We're seeing the same thing in professional football with Black coaches. Like if there's no pipeline, it doesn't, you know, we're going to just continue to, it doesn't ever get better. So I think starting earlier and having those conversations and you probably, you know, I'm a big fan of Girl Scouts, same thing, where they talk, like the whole entire cookie program for Girl Scouts is all about business ownership. I was helping my daughter with it. You learn about inventory management, marketing. We went and did a SWOT analysis in the aisle as part of our badge earn. It was phenomenal. Yeah. So build it in that early. And I love that Girls Inc. is doing that. And I love that you guys are participating in that. Tell me, what is something that you wish everybody knew about Seattle Chocolates? I don't know, you know, because sometimes everybody, okay, you're a chocolate company, you're women owned, blah, blah, blah. Those are all very forward facing. But oftentimes you're like, boy, I really wish everybody knew blank.
About our company specifically.
And that might not be something off the top of your head. You guys might be really transparent about all the things that are really, really important.
Well, we're working on that. But I guess this is one of those things that if you say it, it's not necessarily believable. But what is true and always has been about our company is that we will always do the right thing. It may cost us market share. It may cost us profitability. It often does. Like a good example is our little twist wrap truffles. They used to be in plastic. And I'm a tree hugger. I was like, what? No plastic.
What are we doing?
So we found this literally one vendor in the entire world, and they're in France, that makes a compostable twist wrap. Or a compostable substrate. That then our twist wrap vendor could buy. And it's made from eucalyptus trees, sustainably grown eucalyptus trees. So if you put our twist wrap in your compost bin, it'll disintegrate within 5 or 6 weeks. So when we got that stuff, it was like, it didn't work very well on our, our machines. It was a, you know, it's different, obviously it has a different tension, a different everything. And we had a lot of waste. And so my operations team was like, this stuff is A, twice as expensive. B, there's waste associated with it. We you can't do it. And I'm like, oh yes, we can. And I'll tell you why, because if we don't, then where is the consumer going to go to find the product? You know, it's up to the businesses to provide consumers with good choices. So we're making a difference in the world. So you're darn right, we're going to do it. And if we don't make as much money, you know, which is more important, money or the planet?
I was just at a conference in New Orleans, a packaging conference about environmental substrates and packaging. And the biggest thing that all, and these are all multinationals that were there. We had Pepsi and Coke, Duracell was there, really big name brands. And the number one thing that was talked about is the CPG industry has made waste a consumer issue.
Recycle it or throw it away. Not our job.
But we don't make it easy for them. That's the thing, is we put our little chasing triangle on it and there you go. But sometimes that's multi, you know, multi material packaging or all of the things. And So
I have such a fun story to tell you on this. So yes. There's a woman. Oh my God. What was her name? It'll come to me.
Okay.
She wrote me a letter and she wrote it longhand and she included one of my bar wrappers. This was a few years ago. And she said, "This is garbage." And I'm like, oh, it felt like a hate crime. And then I read on and she was explaining that it's got like a plastic layer on top of the paper, which is keeping it from being recyclable. Well, luckily we never said it was recyclable, but I thought it was. So I responded to her, Betty, her name is Betty. And I said, "Betty, thank you so much for reaching out." But it actually, and I checked with my, you know, vendor and they're like, "Yep, it is." I said, "It actually is, Betty." And she responded back in email and she said, "I didn't want to say, but I've worked my entire career at the Oregon, you know, recycle plant. And I know that it's not."
Right.
So I reached out to my vendor. And I'm like, "Betty says," and they were like, "Oh yeah. By the time you would hear the plastic to the paper, both the plastic and the paper are recyclable, but together they're not." I'm like, "Well, that's an important detail."
Yes.
So it took us about a year to source a paper that was going to be heavy enough. That's not going to get torn at retail and all of the channel considerations. And we did it. And I wrote Betty a note and I said, "Just so you know, it took me a year, but I figured it out. And thank you for telling me." So I didn't know. I was told otherwise.
Yeah.
She said, turns out she's a teacher at like an Oregon university.
Oh my goodness.
And she's now going to use it as a case study.
Yes.
Communicating with people or whatever. So it's one of those fun, like do the right thing examples.
Yes. Well, yay, Betty.
Yay, Betty.
Yeah. And yay you for doing something. Cause you could have easily just discarded it.
Too hard.
Yep. It's going to cost me 2 more cents per unit. Sorry. You know, could have very easily.
Which does matter in the world of chocolate bars.
Yes. So thank you. Thank you for doing something about that. Well, so what's next for you? What's next for Seattle Chocolates or J. Coco? What's exciting? What can we expect from you in the next 12 months?
Well, the big thing this year was the Girls Inc. launch for Seattle Chocolate.
Okay.
And we also have like a new bar called the Sunshine Bar, which is Cheerios. It's not Cheerios.
Yes, sorry, I saw that on your website.
I don't have the clean ingredients, but you know, Honey Nut Cheerio bar. Mm-hmm. And it's really all about like, you know, sending a sentiment of you are sunshine to somebody. Mm-hmm. We also are updating. So that's kind of one of the things that we've done that's a bit unique to us, although people are copying. And that is a sentiment bar. So you're going to spend $4.50 on a chocolate bar. Or you're going to spend $7 on a card that you're going to throw in the recycle bin.
Right.
And they both say happy birthday or thank you or you are sunshine. So that's a new line. I mean, the new happy birthday, thank you, and celebrate bars are all going to be new in a couple of months.
Okay.
And I have some really exciting things, but it's too soon to say.
Oh, darn it. Okay.
And then
when? Summer?
This year.
Okay.
Okay. This year and next year.
Okay.
And then for J. Coco, we just finished doing a complete remodel on that brand after 10 years. And it started shipping in September of in October of 2021. And it's all Peruvian chocolate that are unique blends of these Peruvian beans to us, partnering with a world-class chocolate maker down in Lima, which is unusual for the chocolate makers to be in the same place as the beans and be good. And so that one, is really exciting. And we have an 85%. That's a single varietal. You don't see that very often. And it's so delicious. So
love it.
The taste innovation there has been amazing.
Mm. Thank you. So as we start wrapping up our time together, I just want to thank you again for just really all this work that you're doing out in the marketplace. I'm playing with my hair here. I don't know why, but, I'm good, getting really comfortable with you. I love it when my guests share kind of a fun, interesting, I like it, call it a cocktail fact or a happy hour fact. Do you have anything that you can share about either Seattle Chocolate or just the chocolate industry in general?
Yeah, I think chocolate is so little is known. I mean, you do have more knowledge than most people, but so there's always lots of little tidbits that people don't know, right? So chocolate is America's favorite flavor.
Mm.
You know, no one even comes close. Vanilla is the next closest.
Mm-hmm.
And cacao, which is the root seed for chocolate, is the food highest in antioxidants of any food on the planet.
Really?
Higher than walnuts, higher than blueberries, higher than acai berries, higher than all of those, higher than kale. It's
not
just
kale.
No. Yes. Yeah, I know. You love your kale. You'd rather that than a chocolate bar, but I'm telling you, I'm empowering you to eat chocolate
and
just eat it with a higher percent cacao and you'll get more of the good stuff.
Okay. Wonderful. I will take that to heart, believe me. Now, I wonder, are there any, you know, this show is about elevating women leadership in CPG. Are there any women leaders or rising stars out there that you would like to elevate or just simply admire for the work that they're doing?
Yeah, we just did a partnership, a collaboration, I should say, with Trade Street Jams, which is a New York company.
Okay.
And their founder is Ashley Rouse, and she herself is a chef. And so she applies her expertise and knowledge and inspiration around food to her jams. And she has some unlikely pairings, and they're really, really delicious. And so it reminded us a lot of J. Coco. So we did a J. Coco and Trade Street Jam collaboration. But she also, we felt a synergy with her because she helps kids, underprivileged kids. She teaches them how to make jam, you know, just spends quality time with them. And then if she has any sort of residual jam, she donates it to less fortunate people, kind of along the same lines as what we do for J. Coco with the food bank. So we really admire her. We think her product is great. And she's a woman of color running a company. So that's rare.
Wonderful. Yeah, that is really rare, as we were talking about before we started recording. Thank you for sharing that. Well, we've been talking with Jean Thompson, owner and CEO of Seattle Chocolate Company. Jean, where can people learn more about you and your companies?
Our website, seattlechocolate.com. Mm-hmm. And we'd love more followers on Instagram and Twitter. It's at Seattle Choc, C-H-O-C. And on Facebook and Pinterest, it's at Seattle Chocolate. So join us. We have some gorgeous photography that
makes you hungry.
Yeah.
Yes, you do. Thank you for your time today, Jean. I'm so happy to have spent this time with you and look forward to seeing what's next. And I'll be keeping my eyes peeled. It'll be hard not to. Seattle Chocolates here in the Seattle marketplace are everywhere. Literally, you can't miss them. And so it'll be fun to see what happens in the next year. And I want to thank all of you listeners for your time today. If you like this episode with Jean, please share it with a friend. Otherwise, have a great rest of your day, and we'll catch you next time on the Gooder Podcast.
Thank you, Diana.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you haven't already, be sure to click subscribe and share with your network. Until next time, be well and do gooder.